Okay, so now we're up to session two, and I just want to say a few things, and then we can go at it and go back and forth and talk about all the great things that we were talking about before. And I know some of you didn't get to some of your questions, so bring them up as appropriate. But I want to set the stage a little bit by talking about how Truman came to understand the need for new institutions. You know, if you teach American government, when you think institutions, you're always thinking about the three branches of government and, you know, separation of powers and checks and balances and all that kind of stuff. And Truman was looking at what do we need in terms of institutions in foreign policy. The American government wasn't broken, but something had to be done in order to meet the challenges, these extraordinary challenges, these extraordinary circumstances of the Cold War. So he has the beginnings of these essential policies in 1947, the Truman Doctrine in the spring, the Marshall Plan announced in the summer. But by then, by that point, Truman has already realized that more is needed. And, you know, it's easy to poke fun at technocrats and bureaucrats, and if that's all that somebody is, then, you know, we've got a problem. But it's very good that Truman was president at that time, because you did need somebody who had a good administrative eye, as well as somebody who understood the big picture. So that's probably the most positive thing I'll ever say about somebody who, you know, understands that kind of need for bureaucracy. But Truman, in his efficient way, was going about it too. He wasn't doing it just for the sake of it. Let's put it that way. So once again, Truman, the unintellectual president, was very practical. It turns out sometimes it's good not to have an intellectual for a president. Truman put his attention to restructuring our defense, our security, and our intelligence. And it was really revolutionary. And again, this is something when you're talking with students and you're talking about the quick pace of this period. I mean, I know that when you're teaching American government, American history, there are many times at which you're telling them about the quick pace and quick, you know, succession of events and the people involved and all that stuff. But this period is just amazing when you go over it and you realize how much was happening so quickly. So anyway, he put his attention to restructuring, and it was revolutionary. But he wasn't doing it for the theoretical or philosophical reasons that a Wilson would have done it for. Truman was restructuring because it had to be done, and it was also crucial to waging the Cold War. He couldn't do containment well without doing this, in other words. So Truman was very hands-on in terms of the unification of the military branches into the Department of Defense. He wanted universal military training. This is something he tried for over and over again. He wanted a strength component. He didn't want to always be fighting battles, but he wanted us to have the ability to do things. So this is something that was very important to him throughout his presidency, and he was very frustrated when he couldn't get it passed over and over again. He was very hands-on in terms of promoting from within the CIA, realizing that you needed to restructure what the OSS had done. And I mean, he was always leery of things, too. He didn't like secrecy, and he wanted to have somewhat of a distance, but he knew that it was necessary to have intelligence. And he also wanted something like what would become the National Security Council. And he didn't like initially that Congress jumped on this, that when it came to the National Security Act of 1947, that Congress was so into it. He said, "You're trying to hem in the president. What's going on here?" But he did he did know that there was something that was needed. So he wanted what would become the National Security Council, but he wanted it on his own terms. And now I'm trying to remember if I had assigned that or suggested that chapter. Was that one of the on the NSC? I did have it. Okay, great. So you understand what I'm saying after that. Good. I don't have to go on. This explains his attitude at some of the early National Security Council meetings and how he would then use the council more and more over time. So the institutions of national security and cannot be separated from the strategy of containment. And this would be part of my response. There's a whole line of academic literature that just criticizes the national security state, that goes on and on about how we, you know, we basically turned into a war machine. They will take the very good warnings of Eisenhower, right, and then they will amplify it into an entire critique, I mean, really a serious critique and declamation on all the ways in which the United States has become a horrible security state. I would again go to, what was the Cold War? What were the circumstances? What did we need to do? And argue that these were not, you know, this was not a national security state to be set up to be then, you know, a tyranny, a despotism at home. We can talk more about that if you're interested. So Truman had his big picture principles, especially freedom and the liberal regime and a lot of the things we were talking about in the morning. But he also wanted to figure out how to put things into practice. And I guess that's probably enough to set the stage on this. We can talk about, I hope you all will talk about your impressions of the National Security Council, of NSC 68, and what I talk about that and what I quote from that in the book. And also his entire understanding of collective defense in relation to national security. I think that might be something we could explore if you're interested. I just don't know if that would be getting too specific for your purposes, for some of the things that you teach with your students. And then I don't think I really need to say too much right now about religion, because we've already started talking about it. So just keep asking your questions, and we'll go back and forth on that. So why don't we start with you know, the whole notion of transforming parts of the federal government and doing national security, and start with that in terms of how you're setting up containment. Yes?
Do you think that's why the Congress has balked at his New Deal domestic, or sorry, Fair Deal domestic programs, and didn't want to do the universal health care and all that, because he was already doing so much restructuring as far as...
I think that was part of it. I also think that by the time you get to 47 and 48, you've got a Republican Congress. Right. So they want to undo and not entrench. And even if he was calling it something new, they didn't like, I mean, you know, universal health care, as you point out. Truman's the first one, really, who proposes it. It's not something that even Roosevelt proposed. So you do have more about domestic politics coming in. I mean, as you get more practical on something like this, you're right, you get more and more of the domestic exchange. You know, Truman was trying to keep all of the good lines of communication open to do bipartisanship in foreign policy, but he was getting resistance to some of those domestic programs, that's for sure. Yes?
Truman was noted for breaking from his generals, in particular. You know, Patton, of course, said to go into the Soviet Union, and MacArthur also said to go into China. How did that really hurt his position as president, or did it? And was there any ego involved there?
Well, we are all human beings, so there has to be some kind of ego involved, that's for sure. On the World War II example, by 48-ish, later 48, Truman was, in 49 in particular, he was already writing privately and even said in interviews with an author that became a book in 49 or 50, you know, I really do wish I had listened then, and that we had, you know, let the armies move further east. He said he, you know, he was listening to what Marshall was saying, to what Eisenhower was saying, to what others were saying, and he respected them. And I'm not saying he didn't understand that there's politics even in the middle of a war. He did understand that, but what he was doing was he was going with the judgment of people who he respected. So he did privately change his mind, wish he had made different decisions, wish he had listened to Churchill. He wrote that several times about it. If I had listened to Churchill in some of those early cables, we could have had a different disposition of troops and therefore a different outcome for the Soviets at the end of World War II. So this shows he can learn right? This shows his understanding of things. Is this on this? I was going to keep this. Okay. But then when it comes to the Korean War and MacArthur, I think you have to look at this in the broader context of how Truman looks at the office of the presidency. So he's the president, and he wants to be respected, but he wants to be respected because he's the president, right? And it's the office of the presidency that, whether it was MacArthur, or whether it was James Burns when he was Secretary of State, or whether it was Henry Wallace in 46 especially, what they are doing is, sure, they're disrespecting Harry Truman, but he can deal with that. What it was is they were disrespecting the office of the presidency. And Truman, I mean, this is why he didn't take lightly the restructuring, all these things he ends up trying to do with, you know, to bolster national security, to be able to put containment into practice. He doesn't take any of this lightly because he does revere the institutions. So a lot of that with MacArthur is, I mean, yeah, there's ego and, you know, mano a mano and sandbox and, you know, all that kind of, you know, you can go on and on with your parallels. But a lot of it was, you know, this was a general disrespecting the office of the presidency. Yes?
The 1949 revolt of the admirals, did he take that personally?
I don't know. That's not an area that I've, you know, I didn't go and look up that in the archives, so I don't have specific information more than what we read generally on that one. But you let me know if you find out more. No?
Well, doesn't it seem that it was, I agree as far as it was an issue about the presidency rather than Harry Truman's ego. In that Truman went to MacArthur, and MacArthur wasn't even on time. And that was to see the President of the United States would come to see him.
Right.
So, you know, that can't get much more imperious than MacArthur. I have a question, just for fun, since anybody have a question right now? You're talking about Harry Truman not being an intellectual. Probably nobody would argue about that. But just for fun, in your opinion, seeing all the guys lined up there, who among them would be, in your opinion, the most intellectual five?
Most intellectual five.
Hoover was pretty funny.
Adams would be intellectual.
Yeah, I know. I'm going back to the beginning. Thank you.
Monroe.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of burn out part of your five just at the early part. Yeah.
No, Monroe's not an intellectual.
No, I'd say Adams, Jefferson.
Yes, but not as president.
Yeah. Right, okay, are we doing...
Oh, we're doing it as president.
As president.
Okay, Adams, Jefferson.
It would have been easier to rule out the ones who weren't.
I guess so. No, I don't know about that. John Quincy Adams in some ways.
What about Jimmy Carter?
I think Lincoln should be considered among the intellectuals.
But there's a difference between formal intellectualism and informal. He was clearly an informal intellectual.
Right.
But how do we define intellectual then?
Yeah, I didn't say Herbert. And then, because I'm up to what? Three or four now?
Wilson,
yeah. That gets me up to four or five. Okay. And that's a very good question.
How do you eliminate
Ted? Even in presidency, you're right. I was thinking about him when he's justice, but you're right. Tap two. Okay, so I'm over five now. Yes.
Well, in relation to that, I mean, they usually say that one of the definitions of great presidents is that they are educators.
They are educators.
Educators, right? And
right.
Persuading people,
right.
Pulling
right.
them along, so to speak, whatever. How do you rate Truman in there? I mean, the you have constant examples of him building consensus of the American people for
No, I think he does qualify as an educator when it comes to the Cold War. And if you look at, especially if you spend time going through his speeches, and I mean, I take rhetoric seriously. I don't think it's all about rhetoric, but I do think that, you know, presidential rhetoric is very important. So if you look at his speeches, if you look at his press conferences, he gave tons and tons. I mean, you know, by modern standards, he was talking with them all the time. And they're very revealing. He clearly sometimes had a set piece, something that he wanted to get covered. But then it was back and forth, and he was constantly, you know, here's what the Cold War is about. He didn't really care for the term Cold War, but, you know, here's what the struggle is about that we're in. Here's what we need to do. Here's what they're doing. Here's what we want to change. Here are the principles that are at stake. Here's the, you know, the specifics that are at stake. All of this, it was very much constant for him. And did it grow over time? Did it, you know, did some things get stressed here and there more at certain times given what was going on? Sure. But what strikes me is one of the differences between then and some of this is also the time it was, right? But then and now, is now, you know, you hear, and it's not just true of George W. Bush, it's true of the past several presidents. Oh, so-and-so is going to give a major address on this, or so-and-so is going to have a major statement on this. Take the Truman Doctrine. You know, it was after the fact, several days after the fact, already people are calling it the Truman Doctrine. But there wasn't this buzz around the Washington press corps for the 2 weeks before. Oh, there's going to be this huge speech given. I mean, they knew it was going to be something big because he was coming to give an address before the Congress. But nothing like what we have now where, you know, you can go and find the four most important speeches that such and such a president gave because of the White House announcing that these were the most important ones. So there's a difference there. But I do think Truman very much qualifies as an educator on those terms. Not on every single policy, but certainly on the Cold War. And if you all read the stuff on how he was really trying to do, you know, the equivalent of psychological and political and religious education, the whole campaign of truth, which nobody talks about now. This is very important to how he was trying to educate people about the meaning and stakes of the Cold War. And it was you know, it was years of sustained effort on his part. You have a question?
Kind of answer the question I had. You mentioned the rhetoric. How would you where would you put him in his rhetoric?
His rhetoric.
Place him with the first Roosevelt or Wilson or...
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't known for being an orator. he was scrappy. He had kind of a bullet delivery. notice I'm going immediately to delivery. If you read his speeches, there's a lot of great content. And they can be quite stirring. I mean, it's not necessarily like reading the seamless speech of a, you know, of a Reagan, where you're just like, oh, this really is kind of poetic, whether you agree with it or not. You know, this is beautiful how it's unfolding. With Truman, sometimes it was more workmanlike, but there's really great content in those speeches, and his delivery. You know, where would I? I would rank him. I mean, he was better than Carter. In the modern, you know, I'm thinking the modern era now, where we've heard these speeches, right? Better than Carter. Not as good as Reagan. I think he's better than Bush 41. I started with Carter and I go on. Okay, I mean, you know, he wasn't better than JFK. he was better than Johnson a lot of the time. Nixon was Nixon. Yeah. He's better than Ford. Yeah. and then Clinton is better to listen to than to read often. Mm-hmm. So,
and then.
Come on. President George W. Bush.
Well, he can read.
Well, that's not a fair evaluation because they don't speak the same language.
wouldn't part of that, too, though, because there are those who were used to listening to FDR for years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, you know, FDR, better speeches, better content, reassuring.
Right.
And as far as understanding the Soviet Union and things like that, in many ways, I have to say, FDR was a real knucklehead. And, you know, I guess maybe it's kind of interesting because we kind of blow hot and cold on the issues. You know, on the one hand, we want to judge people by what they say, you know, and we also don't want to be elitist and jump on people if they don't spell everything right and all that. Yet, what happens is we're kind of real ambivalent about that.
Right. Right. It turns out we want everything done right.
Yeah, and of course we don't really mean it, because if we like where someone's coming from, then we like the folksiness.
Right.
But if we, you know, and if they're polished and we don't like them, then they're slick.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things you see in the partisanship of both sides. That is, you know, oh great, they don't have foreign policy experience. Someone fresh. Because they're our guy, but oh, they don't have foreign policy experience. Well, they're not our guy.
Right.
You know, it's just.
No, I think that's a great point.
Yeah. When you talk about rhetoric being important, at least Harry Truman, Eisenhower, JFK, etc., with some exceptions, those were their words.
Right.
Not some speech writer who was putting ideas, arguably, in some people's heads.
Truman had some help with speech writing. He did. But they were a lot of his words. They were a lot of his words. He also was very hands-on in terms of going back and forth with the people he liked working with best on speeches. So there is that difference. Even within the modern era, you start having more speech writers doing more of the writing than the presidents. Like with Reagan, he would have lots and lots of handwritten notes. I mean, he was still very participatory in his speeches, which he listened to FDR too, right? He had that. You know, if you learn good rhetoric, right, then you're going to be able to do good rhetoric. Yes.
I'd like to ask a trivia question.
Sure.
About the man after his presidency. All I've ever heard is that he sort of disappeared, went back home, you know, to Missouri, and then you just see him putting toast in the toaster. And of course, we know that as his popularity plummeted for a while after the MacArthur incident. Can you tell us a little bit about, anything about his thoughts after he left the presidency?
Right, yeah. No, his post-presidency, it's not flamboyant, but it's significant. He went ahead and was dedicated to building the Truman Presidential Library. And that is, it is a fantastic presidential library, and it's the serious model for subsequent presidential libraries. It really is. And he was hands-on about that. And that was very time-consuming. So he was doing that. The other thing he did a lot of speaking. And he did a lot of speaking to religious audiences. So some of the things that you can figure out about him, about his understanding, you can't always apply what somebody says at the end to what they were, what it meant when they were president. But it does help inform the presidency, right, without, sort of reading back too much into it. And so he would go and he would do these major speeches to various religious audiences, all different denominations. And he would talk about especially world politics and the Cold War. And so this was very important to him, and something that he was continuing beyond, what he had started in his presidency, he was continuing beyond his presidency. He was also very interested in American politics still, and talked frequently with the later presidents. JFK a little bit with the Johnson era. You have Clark Clifford back in the Johnson era, so there's a lot of communication going on. He ends up becoming really good friends with Hoover. He had used Hoover to help him with several things during his presidency. but they were still in tension in terms of their personal relationship. And after, when they were both old, they essentially mended the differences. And there's a lovely correspondence. There's a book of their correspondence that, if you're interested, it's very interesting because obviously they were from different parties and all that. But that's good. So that's that's a lot of what he did, and it wasn't now what you expect from Jimmy Carter or Bush 41 or Clinton, because I think there's a different, it was a different day, and he wanted to go home. He really wanted to go home. He had served his time and he wanted to go home. I mean, like George Washington wanted to go back to Mount Vernon. Harry Truman wanted to go back to independence, and I'm not saying that Harry Truman
wouldn't be in Washington either.
Right. I'm not saying that Harry Truman is, it's George Washington. I'm just saying that they had that same kind of sensibility.
Well, the thing that always struck me that I like, and I think you get this from Merle Miller's Plain Speaking, which I think is a lovely book, with its inaccuracies.
Surely.
That's where Harry Truman stands out. He saw himself as a steward of the office. And as a steward, he was not tainted to a great degree, not tainted by it, unlike other people who let the office go to their head and then they're president forever.
Right.
He said, I'm a citizen, I have been president, I want to be a citizen.
Right, I'm going to serve, serve a turn, and then somebody else is going to be serving.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a key insight to Truman. Every president has to have some sort of ambition, right? They wouldn't become president otherwise. And even though he was an accidental president, he had some sort of ambition to get to where he'd gotten. He wouldn't have become senator, it's not like people knocked on his door and said, we want you to become senator. Here, go to Washington. But all that said, he didn't have that kind of driving ego about it or the I'm the be-all, the end-all because I am president. You probably have all of you met some members of Congress at one point or another. Sometimes you get these, some of these members of Congress, it doesn't matter what their politics are, but they just think, they think they're God. They really think they are the center of the universe, and, they can be 20 minutes late, but heaven forbid, you're only on time, and all that kind of stuff, and he didn't have any of that. He didn't have any of that. And that's why he didn't like it in others. I mean, to go back to McCarthy and the other things, it's why he detested it in others. Did you have something? Yeah.
Did Truman ever foresee a demise of the Soviet Union?
He did. He dreamed about it, in fact, and he wrote about it in his private journal writings, and he also talks about it in his farewell address. Was that one of the things I had y'all?
Yeah.
Where he talks about how it's going to be a better world and it's going to be after it. He had great faith in the young. He wrote frequently about trusting that future generations would be able to help get us out of the Cold War. He was the one who sort of dictated the philosophy behind NSC 68, which talked about the attraction of freedom and free governments and free markets, and that this would be something that would just overwhelm the Soviet Union at some point, and that the Soviet Union would not be able to sustain itself, but it would also be assaulted from without. So he thought that you could do it. It wasn't the to go back to Kennan as a contrast, it wasn't the realist sort of, eventually they will implode because they can't sustain themselves that long. With Truman, it was the West will be doing stuff. We will be carrying the battle to them in all these various ways, political, diplomatic, military when necessary, strategic. He would have very much approved of a lot of the stuff of, it was being done in co-ed ways in the 40s, but the later efforts to help dissidents and underground and intellectuals and all that sort of stuff. He was all on board with that kind of stuff.
At times, we see the Soviet Union or Russia's problems handling various things economically and so on. And sometimes you'll see in the paper demonstrations of people saying something to the effect, this isn't working, let's go back to communism. You even see them marching with big placards that have pictures of Stalin on them. If Harry Truman saw that, would he say the Cold War is over?
I think he'd say the Cold War was over. I think he would be very concerned, though, about Russia and about how should we be encouraging Russia to move in a better direction. where would we be supporting? I mean, he would still see the reason for things like the VOA. You know, a lot of the cutbacks and things. Now I realize we've got a whole other front going on now and a whole other war. But, you know, cutbacks on things having to do with the Freedom Radios and, I mean, a lot of things have even been closed, but things that were specifically targeted, especially VOA and all that kind of public diplomacy toward Russia, he would have said you have to nurture something too, you know, see it through that way. I do think he would have been very attentive to that. Yeah.
Did, in his post-presidential period, did he ever comment publicly or privately on the Cold Warriors that followed him? I don't mean Churchill, but I mean the American presidents as Cold Warriors.
Yeah. Okay, he had a difficult relationship with Eisenhower. and he didn't dismiss what the Eisenhower administration was doing, but I do think that was one of those occasions where his personal feelings clouded his ability to look dispassionately at the policies of the Eisenhower administration. So he never, he didn't slam them all the time, he didn't slam them publicly, but in some of his correspondence, like some of his private correspondence with Acheson after Truman is back home, you know, there were some criticisms of Eisenhower. He had great hopes for Kennedy and hoped that he was in the, you know, same sort of spirit. And they got to talk, they got to meet. And I don't remember him saying too much about Johnson, at least in the, you know, the correspondence I've read. You know, later on in that presidency, he's starting to go into decline anyway. Yeah. Yes?
I think, going back to my question with Dover the Hawk, but I have, I think I answered the question here because, you know, we don't want to mention Truman in the same words as Washington, but in a way, in his farewell address, he was, because we think of Washington as being the first one to do certain things. Well, in essence, it didn't matter what his relationship was with the other presidents that followed him, because in one simple sentence in his farewell address, I'm sure every president after him thought about this before they acted, and just starting an atomic war is probably unthinkable for a rational man. And I could just see the Pentagon general saying, that son of a... Because he basically set our whole foreign policy. I don't know if he intended to or not, but that keyword rational put an incredible amount of pressure on basically everybody that followed him.
Right. That's an excellent point. Excellent point.
And I bet you Kennedy was thinking about that sentence.
Right, and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yeah, or somebody was reminding him of it or something, yeah. And I'll come back to Hawk and Dove. We'll get there. Yeah.
It got to be sort of astounding as the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, 1990s kind of went little by little by little. Presidents, whether they were Democrat or Republican, started quoting Truman,
right.
Yeah, I mean, he became the sort of the spokesman that everybody could, you know, read something out of and be seen as a real politician. Is there something that most of those presidents had seen that GW doesn't see? I mean, we don't hear, you know, anything from GW about, you know, Truman's policies or principles or, and yet, you know, you could take a look at a lot of Truman's principles, especially with religion and other sorts of things. I think he'd be a perfect one.
George W. Bush has actually given a couple of recent speeches where he's invoked Truman and the Truman era directly and explicitly. So, I mean, very recently, like within the last month or two. So,
on his 6-week.
Yes, yeah. And that most recent thing, his commencement speech at the at West Point, you know, he went back to West Point. Remember how he gave a famous commencement speech at 02, so it was after, the first commencement speech he gave after September 11th, he gave at West Point, right? I think that was the case. And then he went back again this past May, June, whenever it was. And again, there's a Truman theme in that one. And then you got some stuff in just the last month or so. And the other person who's explored it in speeches and in other statements is Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. And she's even invoked the Acheson model, you know, like the Truman era and the Cold War for the big level, and then even the Acheson model for what she's trying to do as Secretary of State.
Is this trying to rebuild consensus, which they sort of tore apart?
I think it could be some of that. I think it's also trying to define and explain the struggle, the conflict, what the war on terror. I mean, you know, Truman didn't care for the Cold War as a term, but you know, we're stuck with it. I don't care for the term war on terror, but we're stuck with it. So anyway, trying to define and explain and defend too, but promote, educate, all of this, I think, is wrapped up in it. And I also think, I mean, we can't relive history, right? But we have to learn from history. And I think that President Bush and Secretary Rice are very attentive to that. So they're not trying to say this is a replay of the Cold War, but what's your previous epic struggle that wasn't just all a big hot war? Well, it was the Cold War, right? And we've heard the World War II parallels, and Bush has made some of those too. You know, certainly among the pundits and the press, you get the, you know, is it 1919, is it 1930-something, is it 1940-something, you know, what year is it? You got those debates going on. But all that said, you know, there are a lot of historical parallels. I mean, there are a lot of differences, too, but there are a lot of historical parallels, and I think that even if they're trying to understand the particulars of what we're involved in now, Bush and Rice and others are trying to find where can we draw from our history. And if they would carry this through, then the bipartisanship model is something that they should really grab onto from the Truman era as well. And that's something that really strikes me over and over again, because, you know, things were rancorous back in the 40s, too. I'm sure some of you have read about the 48 election. You know, boy, that was really polite language that was used, right? I want to be called Hitler when I'm out there stomping. You know, I mean, that's what Truman said. That's, you know, like he's Hitler. Or, you know, you vote for the Republicans and you're supporting the communists. That's not exactly nice language. And, I mean, it was all over the place. It wasn't just Truman. So you had that. But especially in that period of 47, 48, where you've got Arthur Vandenberg at the helm for the Republicans in the Senate in terms of foreign policy, you know, and the foreign relations. You know, there's a reason why people call it the golden age of bipartisanship, because there was so much back and forth. Now, Vandenberg was always willing to be just a senator. I mean, not just a senator. You know what I mean? He wasn't trying to be president. So he was always trying to do this from the perspective of being, you know, a senator. So yes, I have my job to do as a member of Congress, but also I have my president. But, you know, he would have preferred for Truman to have been a Republican, and Truman would have preferred for him to have been a Democrat, but they knew each other, right? They had served in the Senate together, they knew each other, and they worked together. And then the other thing, you know, as a model would be Truman constantly had people under him going back and forth. I mean, whether this was, you know, people having drinks or people having dinner with each other or going to the offices of each other and back and forth. It wasn't like the White House people were always going over the Hill and the Hill people were always going over to the White House. It was both ways. All of these kinds of things, I would hope, certainly I hope some of it's already being done, and then I would hope more of it would be done, because that's another part of the model. I mean, that would be good for any era, because, you know, we're a big power, we've got foreign policy, it's not going down. It's a big world, but it is more interconnected. The United States is always going to have to be doing stuff. We have to figure out how to have bipartisan foreign policy.
Would you say being a senator before was a key to this, being able to do that, because you compare, there was midterm elections in 18 and then 46, and both Democratic presidents have a Republican Senate to contend with, and we see how Wilson was not able to
yes.
work with that,
yes.
and yet Truman was.
Yes. No, I think it's very important. And this is also part of the reason he's an accidental president, because, I mean, you can have senators make it on their own to the Oval Office, but typically, you know, especially in the modern era, it's governors, you know. And there's something, this is, it often doesn't work. I mean, you know, you can see it when senators are campaigning for president. It's like, oh boy, they're just not presidential. They just don't have that executive quality about them. But with Truman, he grew into it very quickly, but he had the understanding of the Senate, and I think that was just really important. Yes?
Do you think some of the rhetoric that we heard at the UN just this week might help bring what you said into focus? Because it seems to me that up to this point, there's been a pretty widespread ignorance about what the world thinks of, you know, what so many, many people in the world think of America.
Sure.
And it's been somewhat sidetracked by because of the rancor against Bush. A lot of people said, well, of course they're mad. They don't like us because of Bush. But a lot of that transcended that. They just don't like us.
Right.
It transcends Bush. And it's, you know, we've got this whole thing is, you know, we have to understand this thing in terms of the whole world, not just the one president.
Well, you know, after these comments,
And the responses that came back.
When some of the Democrats came out after these statements, and they made really strong comments. You know, this is if I had been high up in the Bush administration, maybe they did this. It's like, I'm going over to Nancy Pelosi's office now. I'm going to tell her how great that was. We're gonna talk about it, and we're gonna figure out a way. I mean, you're not gonna get her on board on a whole bunch of other things, but maybe yes. But a lot of this requires personal contact. Right? And doing it over and over and over again. And frankly, you know, schmoozing. I guess mutual schmoozing, but schmoozing these members of Congress and you know, vice versa, but really going after them and courting them in a way. I mean, there's no other way to put it, right? Yes?
How do you think that he would see the problems that we're starting to see in Asia with, you know, North Korea back in the news again, and of course China becoming the economic powerhouse that it's becoming, is that one of those things that he would see as an extension of the Cold War? I mean, you said before that he would say that the Cold War is over.
With respect to the Soviet Union, that's for sure. I don't know if Truman. Truman would probably say, we're going to have a long-time residue effect from the Cold War. You know, if he would say, okay, the Soviet Union collapsed and the Eastern Bloc had already fallen apart, we're into the 90s, the Cold War, as we knew it, is over. But he would be one to say, you know, there's still China, there's still North Korea, there's still these problems. So, especially with respect to North Korea, he would say, you know, this is somebody who's still a committed ideologue and a crazy man. You know, and the combination of those is really scary. I mean, you know, one or the other is scary, but now you have, like, you know, scariness to the nth degree. So I think he would be very concerned about North Korea. With respect to China, I know that, you know, the human rights violations would still just terribly annoy him and bother him and depress him. And, you know, he wrote things about China. But he would probably say, you know, also let's be looking at what will the next generation of Chinese be looking like. You know, how far down the road do we have to look before you get ones who are less wedded to the party?
Could he even see that, though? I mean, is there that kind of hope?
A lot of people will talk about not the next generation, but the one after, that they are supposedly not as ideological, that, you know, if intelligence is to be believed, that some of them are waiting and hoping that they can move China, you know, more and more, not necessarily to a free and open democracy, but to a better kind of more open government. And that so much of this is longevity, that you know, you have these Chinese leaders in for so long, and that you have to wait, maybe not even just the next, and I'm not talking like a generation of 20 years at a time, I'm just talking about like the next generation of leaders, so it's like the one after the next that a lot of people have their eye on for China. Yes?
I can tell by reading your book you have a great amount of admiration for Mr. Truman, but couldn't somebody say that he obviously missed a great opportunity in the Korean War situation, when you think of North Korea now and then China now, and how this could have been, when you consider that he more or less discounted the importance of one-fifth of the world's people in such an important country, where obviously Nixon didn't. He saw the importance of that.
I focused on the Soviets. I mean, I focused on what he saw. You know, I was trying to understand Truman as he understood himself. And he was focused on the primary threat. So I focused on the primary threat. Do I think he was weak on Asia? Do I think there were some problems? You know, if you're going to go ahead and apply completely his Cold War understanding, his approach to everything, his liberal internationalism to everything, then yes, by his own standards, he failed on China and on Korea. But I'm really glad he did what he did, and I don't know that he could have been comprehensive. I don't know that he, you know, physically could have done it. I don't know that we had the resources. I mean, you know, do I deplore what happened in the intervening years? Yes. You know, growing up, we had dinner visitors who swam shark-infested waters to get away from China. You know, we had boat people in our house. I deplore all of this. I don't like tyranny either. You can see why I wanted to write about Truman, right? It's definitely a weakness on his part. But I think that he laid out the right approach, right? And I'm glad he did what he did with respect to the Soviet Union.
I was surprised to read Kennan's reference to Reinhold Niebuhr as, let's say, the father of all realists. I had never thought of Niebuhr in a foreign policy sense.
He wrote a lot on it, actually. He was also very much involved in the founding of the ADA. He was considered their spiritual intellectual, when Eleanor Roosevelt and others were forming the Americans for Democratic Action. Kennan, I mean, he remained a realist. He was often sort of like almost a skeptic on a lot of things, religious and spiritual. But he very much admired Niebuhr. And that quote, it is a fascinating quote. It's quite insightful on that whole intellectual cohort. Yeah. Yes?
Just a follow-up on that. Truman may have done something different over with Korea.
Right.
We now know that Joseph Stalin was the driving force behind China doing that. And if we had gone in and said, well, we can stop these people, the consequences would be catastrophic.
Right. No, I agree. Yes.
As far as Truman's commitment to human rights, I'm just curious as to what you think his view would be of the recent issues regarding torture and Geneva Convention and so on.
Mm-hmm. Now we're getting really counterfactual, right? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I know, you know, we had people who defected, even in the 40s and early 50s. We had people that we were getting information from during that time. I don't know how they were treated. A lot of things you can't still find out. You know, they're closed, even though you've got all those archives to look at. Or you have to know where to look, and nobody knows where to look. You know, that kind of thing. He wouldn't have been, you know, for torture, but I don't think George W. Bush is for torture. Would he have handled it differently? I don't know. Would he have? The Geneva Convention is ambiguous on some of this stuff. It also talks about it with respect to actual combatants. Would he have gotten himself into the conundrum of Guantanamo Bay? I don't know. He might have had some foresight. Oh, we don't want to be the ones running this. But then you get into the whole rendition thing, and then you have, you know, some other nasty people doing some nasty. I mean, you know, people we need, but doing nasty things.
Yeah, but if he would have been appalled at what China would do as far as human rights.
Yeah.
When you said he would be appalled at that.
Yeah. At what the Chinese do. Yeah. No, I think he would be appalled the other way too. Yeah.
What's his reaction to Japanese internment?
He's good.
Like that.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm trying to remember what during the Senate years, if anything. I think he thought it was necessary, and I don't remember a particular quote, but I remember, you know, it was necessary during World War II. He, you know, there would have been necessity. There would have been questions of necessity, whether this would rise to He would have wanted information out of some of the terrorists now, that's for sure. He would have wanted to make sure that they were terrorists, but he would have wanted information out of them. How that would be done, I don't know. But, you know, just like President Bush isn't the one doing the actual questioning, right? Nor would Truman have been.
On the flip side, did he, you know, choose to put the blinders on when it came to something like communist infiltration in the government? You know, that, yeah, it might have happened, but we're not going to go after it and try to root it out. That he didn't want to fully move down the road of whining
witch
hunt.
What he didn't like is that people wanted to politicize it, okay? So he, you know, when his whole, the whole thing about red herrings and criticizing McCarthy and others on that point, that was, you know, you're getting in the way of us doing what we should be doing. And actually, there was less communist infiltration in the Truman administration compared to the Roosevelt administration. And likely Truman knew that. So he probably thought, we're going in a better direction, we're fixing the problem, this shouldn't be something we should bring a lot of public attention to, let's get rid of them if they don't pass their various... I mean, because there were, you know, there were questions going on, people were questioned, and the loyalty program, you know, this whole thing, which he came to reluctantly. This was sort of a necessity thing. He didn't want to do it, but he came to, you know, he said, okay, we're going to do this. But he wanted it in a very... strict understanding. He wanted a very strict understanding of it. You know, I don't know. When he was behind doors with Acheson, and Acheson was saying, Alger Hiss is getting a bum deal. He's my friend. I'm going to stand by him. I don't know what... first of all, I don't know that they had that conversation. Second of all, I don't know what his response would have been. But he didn't want communists in the government. I mean, that's for sure. But I think he would have wanted a quieter... You know, he thought there had been progress made in rooting out some of them, and he would have wanted that sort of quiet way of doing it rather than this, you know, the big flamboyant. You know, he thought that only helped the communists. Yes?
Do you know if he agreed with the approach that Roosevelt took on the division of Germany, or was, did he have any statements about the Morgenthau plan or anything like that?
He didn't make a lot of public statements on it, but he wasn't for the Morgenthau plan. So. Yeah. Yes?
Is there any information on was there a difference the way Wilson looked at Palestine and Truman looked at Palestine, both of them Christians?
I don't know as much of the Wilson. Do other people here? Has anybody done any reading here on Wilson, on Palestine, other than, you know, what you read in basic history books? I don't know the nitty-gritty of that. That's a great question.
I don't even know if it was an issue.
I mean, it was just part of the bundle of things that were coming out of World War One negotiations.
I mean, obviously he's willing to let it become a protectorate of Great Britain after
right.
the war. So.
Right. Well, what I mean, what can you use from Truman? I mean, maybe I should ask you, so I know what next we should talk about. Most of you're all teaching American history, American government, right? So how detailed can you get? I mean, are you doing like a sweeping thing on the Cold War when you do your teaching? Do you do, you know, are you doing case studies? It's been a long time since I was in high school. What are you doing these days in terms of how you're presenting the material? You know, when I was in high school, it was a miracle if you made it up to the Korean War. Is it still the case, or, you know?
Prepping for standardized tests.
Okay.
We're not leaving anybody behind.
No, but...
I'm not
sure.
I mean, what would... You know, we have about a half hour left. What should we make the most of our time here in terms of talking about with respect to Truman and the Cold War?
Try to make some kind of connection between foreign policy and domestic policy after World War II, how closely tied that is, and how one affects the other. Politically, if you're messing up this one area, it may then affect on how you do in the other area. I try to make some kind of tie in that way. I was going to ask you, how does, you know, somebody may mention the loyalty program and how some of those things play off, make him more trustworthy to the American people or less.
Right. Okay. Good. What else? Yes.
Constitution. A lot of focus on the interpretation, the shift in powers, and, you know, like giving away, Congress giving away its authority.
Right.
Gulf of Tonkin and...
Right. Okay. What else? Yes.
I tend to talk a lot about the culture of the Cold War and how, you know, it impacts the average American in so many ways, everything from entertainment to, you know, political leanings to everything.
Sure. any other major area? Yes.
Just one question some students may ask. In terms of Truman followed Roosevelt, who was quite a popular, you know, I mean, everybody knows Roosevelt.
Right.
Where would historians rank Truman in the terms of his presidency, like in the top 10% of greatness? Or
right. He has risen to the near great ranks. He was not there. initially, he was not there. He was at a 32% rating when he left the White House. And it's fascinating to look at. He wrote and rewrote in his longhand notes about why he wasn't going to run. And this ties a little bit, I mean, you know, obviously the two-term thing for president is not in the Constitution, but it goes to his understanding of the presidency. The historical precedent kind of thing was that he considered himself to have essentially served the equivalent of two terms, right? And he wrote constantly about this and about what George Washington had done by setting down the two-term precedent. And even though he was elected once, he thought it was essentially the equivalent of two terms because he had served so much of FDR's term, and that it was just about 8 years anyway. So he wrote that over and over again. But he was keenly aware that he was not popular, that he would have had a hard time, that, you know, Eisenhower was being courted by both parties, that, you know, he... If 48 had been difficult, then 52 would have been really impossible. So, I mean, there were those practical considerations. So when he left, the first wave of scholarship on Truman was very critical. Well, back up. First, you had some of the memoirs and sort of personal accounts, like Merle Miller's book and some of the others. And those were trying to make the, you know, Harry Truman's great kind of, or man of the people, good instincts, did really well in the circumstances that he faced, all that sort of portrait of the man kind of approach. But then you had, as those of you, especially who are historians, will know, you had things going on in the academy that helped to make sure that the academic portrait of Truman was very, depressed. The rise of revisionism, the rise of the new left politically, very much affected the discipline of history. And so you had historians accusing Truman of causing the Cold War. You know, if they were historians who were interested in the individual factor, right? Or you had historians saying that the United States caused the Cold War, if they were interested in the, you know, the state and system level explanations. Or you had historians saying both, right? So there was a long period of that, and that carries you, you know, that's through the 60s, into the 70s even. And then you have post-revisionism. Probably all of you have read John Lewis Gaddis at some point, or you know, if you haven't picked up his latest synthesis on the Cold War. I don't agree with everything, but it's a nice history. It would be good for teaching purposes. Anyway, that one said, well, you know, it wasn't all Truman or it wasn't all the United States. You really had misunderstandings on both sides, problems on both sides, but not focusing on the ideology in the way that the revisionists did. You saw the ideology of the United States as the problem, not the ideology of the Soviet Union. So you had your post-revisionists. And then you have, you know, your corporatists in the 90s and to the present. And they are more back to kind of a neo-revisionist view on economic factors with sometimes a more realist or post-revisionist understanding of strategic and political factors. But along the way, then, you also have these various polls and rankings going on. And I really think a lot of the reason to do with Truman's resurgence in popularity had to do with the popular biographies. And this brought Truman to the attention of people again and made people realize that he had been president in difficult times, and though he had all sorts of failures. I mean, you know, I'm doing mostly a defense of Truman, really trying to what was Truman thinking and how did he try to do it, right? But so people were starting to look at him again on those terms. And so the biography by David McCullough was a turning point in a lot of senses, and Truman's ratings started to climb, and now he's in this near great category. So he's in the same category now with Reagan, and you know they had a lot of similar attitudes about the Cold War. It's kind of interesting to me that they end up in the same category now, and it took Reagan less time to get into that category, of course, than Truman. But that's where he is now. Yes.
I have two questions. One is, what role did, I forget when it was, but I remember I had it on vinyl, originally, the James Whitmore one-man show.
Oh, yeah. Give him hell, Harry. I think that's of a piece, too, with the popular kind of, yeah. And I forget what year that was. Does anybody recall?
So the 70s or early 80s. It's been around
long
a while.
Ago.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I do think
it may still be new to you, Ben.
And the other
it's classic.
and the other question is, this is one of the things I think that's often useful for making students realize why history is an ongoing
right.
project and historiography is interesting. Because, and so I was going to ask you to talk some about how the opening up of archives has, how radically has that changed our view, and maybe mention some of the areas where we now know.
Right.
For instance, one of the things like with things like Alger Hiss.
Right. Exactly. Whether we're talking about on the domestic front or whether we're talking about abroad. These archives that have opened up throughout the former Soviet Union and the Eastern and Central European countries, it's been phenomenal. In part because I couldn't have written this book without those open, because then it would have been, you know, you're just saying this is what Truman said. But now the archives, if anything, almost to a piece, they are confirming what Truman knew. Now, he had information. You know, he got daily briefings, they had intelligence briefings, all this sort of stuff. But there was a lot of this that, you know, he didn't know the kinds of details that we know now from the archives being open. So it makes his statesmanship, I think, even that much more impressive. You know, yes, he wasn't perfect and all that kind of stuff. But it makes his, you know, his statesmanship that much more impressive, because, you know, you've got to do it in the moment when you're the statesman rather than writing about it afterwards. So the archives have been critical to a rehabilitation of Truman. Now, most of those come after McCullough's biography. If you're going to use that and some of these other popular books that we're coming, that we're talking about, or the, you know, the album, Give Him Hell, Harry, the one-man show. But you know, McCullough was writing a popular history, so he anticipated, but he didn't have access to a lot of these archives because, you know, things were not opened until into the 90s. Things having to do with a lot of the domestic espionage, things having to do with Alger Hiss, you know, you still, of course, encounter people who say that he was given a raw deal, that he was innocent, blah, blah, blah. The archives all show. I mean, you know, you read it, it's very specific. And do you all know the Cold War International History Project website? It's a great website. You can read in translation these archives. You do not need to go and get, you know, the copies of them from somewhere. You can look at them. It's the Cold War International History Project. It's based out of the Wilson Center, the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., which is a government-funded think tank, essentially, the Wilson Center. And one of the divisions of it is the Cold War International History Project. They have done yeoman's work in terms of making available to the global public these documents and translations from archives. There's also a great line of books in a series from Yale. I think there's a series at both Yale and a series at Harvard. I think both of those academic presses have a series with a lot of things in translation. And so, like you said, Alger Hiss, a lot of other things having to do with the Communist Party of the United States. If you want to read on the 20s and 30s, I mean, you know, before our period, there's a whole bunch of stuff now in translation. What's interesting is that some of the archives with respect to the period we've been talking about were briefly opened, then they were closed again. So some people got some stuff out, and then they were closed again. Now, some of them have been opening up again, but now, you know, Putin... So anyway, things have been sort of on and off there. Yeah, I mean, what are we going to... talk about residue. he would have been very happy in the cold war. I mean, he was very happy during the cold war. So at any rate, but everything we've been able to glean, everything that's come out from that period, only confirms Truman. Whether you're talking about even the stuff having to do with how the communists tried to say that they had totally disbanded the Comintern first and then the Cominform, or is it the other way around?
Comintern was first.
Comintern, thank you. So the Soviets always maintained that they had totally disbanded the Comintern. So you've got these archives that have opened up, especially like in Hungary and elsewhere, that show, no, they truly just renamed it by renaming it, by calling it the Comintern, but that whole period in the 40s before the Comintern starts in 47 or whenever it is, they were just doing everything possible. So whether you're talking, you know, here or abroad, it's all there, and especially the Cold War International History Project website. It's really great to look at on that. Yes?
Because I was going to say, I think the problem is that when people talk about Cold War era, one of the names that's almost always talked about is McCarthy.
Right.
And McCarthyism. Right. And that becomes kind of a model.
Yes.
And I remember who it was. I think it was like one of the Trellins or somebody who wrote some essay that I've never been able to find since, but I read it years ago, that said something about the great tragedy of McCarthyism was not that he was that he overdid things and the way he did it, that what it did was basically make people think that there was no problem, that it was all imagined, that it was all overheated rhetoric. So
Right. No, I see this with my students. And my students are mostly juniors, and in the spring semester I get second semester sophomores in college mixed in with my juniors. But I see the same thing. When I will talk about the Cold War, I mean, we're doing usually more topical classes in my program, but I will always talk about history, right, in order to talk about now what we're doing. And so I will start using Cold War examples, and inevitably, I mean, it takes seconds, and then it becomes about McCarthy rather than about the Cold War. So I agree with you. I agree that this is a constant challenge in terms of teaching this period, and it's why Truman is such a good model, because you can talk about what he was trying to do. Now, there are people who are trying to rehabilitate McCarthy. You guys have probably seen some of this. So, you know, trying to say that there was more there than my peer. I don't know that subject. I'm not getting into it. But I do think Truman gives you a way. And he's interesting. He's lively. I mean, especially as a teaching tool. You can tell the stories to get the students in to help them see what the conflict was about. Yes. I'll go back. Should I go? Yes.
I've always been fascinated how people talk about how Truman was an honest guy, straight shooter, but he did come out of the Pendergast political machine.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what kind of impact he had. Baggage?
Well, it made him very interesting. As a Baptist, he was never really anti-Catholic. I mean, he was anti. Jesuit, he was, you know, he would cast aspersions on Machiavelli as a representative for Catholicism. I mean, he did all these peculiar kinds of things. But the Pendergasts were largely Catholic. So as a result, you know, he had friends who were Jewish, he had friends who were Catholic, even when he was younger, not just when he was in business and in the army. He had friends who were Mormon. He had friends who were, you know, because Missouri was a great place for the Mormons to stop off before they went on to Utah. He had friends across the Protestant denominations. So one good effect of his exposure to the Pendergast machine is that unlike some others of his generation, he really wasn't a religious, you know, bigot or whatever you would want to call it. He, you know, there were times where he understood what Stalin was trying to do in terms of, okay, here's machine politics, but he didn't forget that, you know, Stalin's a tyrant, and that's different in kind ultimately. And there's no evidence that he was wrapped up in the corruption. I mean, that's fascinating to me. I mean, you dig, you dig, and it means he understood machine politics, but he wasn't, you know, he sort of wasn't involved in it in the way that, you know, this unsavory side of it.
Did the Puerto Rican nationalist assassination attempt mark him anyway?
I'm not saying it didn't affect him, and he was certainly glad to have survived it. But he was quick to praise those, you know, the Secret Service. And I mean, he was very secure in himself. You know, he had seen battle. Somebody tried, you know, they tried to assassinate him. He was in difficult moments at many times. I think he was a pretty, you know, even-tempered guy in a lot of ways, even though he could get passionate about things. But he doesn't write about that. It's very interesting. You go through his journal writings, and he doesn't write about that. Now, he doesn't write he gives interviews subsequently about dropping the atomic bombs, but he doesn't write about that either. He doesn't write about some of these big things that one would expect somebody to commit to paper. Does that mean he felt them even more keenly? Did he think he didn't need to write about them? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But it doesn't seem to have marked him. Did you have something?
I took a seminar one time on great presidents or whatever, and one of the points that was made was that the Cold War is one of the few times in American history that throughout several administrations, everybody pretty much agrees. And
right.
Part of what was attributed to was that Truman laid down some nice foundation, good principles, some basic strategies. All the remaining presidents bought into it and should all be given credit. There was a question came up about Reagan saved the world.
Right.
And he said, no.
Right.
If you look, you got to give a lot of credit to Truman and then how everybody more or less followed the whole
story. Right. No, I do go back to, you know, wow, thank God it was Truman. Because your alternatives at the time, you know, would have been so much different. I mean, including William O. Douglas would have been different. You know, he thought it was an exaggerated threat, all that sort of stuff. Wallace, it certainly would have been different. And he does lay down. And then you have Eisenhower. I read about this a little bit in the conclusion, but Eisenhower is really building on Truman. And JFK certainly, especially rhetorically, building on Truman. And then LBJ, even though he gets mired in Vietnam, he's also, and you know, he's different rhetorically, but he's building on it too. Nixon, he comes out of apparently a Cold War tradition, right, when he's a vice president and a stalwart in the Republican Party. But he is influenced by this more realist strain that I was talking about at the outset. And some of this is Kissinger, but some of this is Nixon. It's not just Kissinger. And he is somebody who thinks that you can, through negotiations and calibrations and getting everything arranged just right, that you can mitigate that conflict enough that you can have stability in it. We had reached parity, or the Soviets had reached nuclear parity with us. That did change some things, I understand. But he really tries to do something different. Does he totally abandon the containment? No. But he picks up more the strand of it that Truman didn't lay out. He picks out what I would argue is that more Kennan-esque strain, and that's what he's trying to do. Ford is kind of a continuation of Nixon. Carter, again, tries to get out of the Truman model. As you all know, he was concerned about, they're all concerned about peace, but he was concerned about that kind of global peace with, you know, North-South differences. He wanted to get out of what he thought was the Cold War box. He is more Wilsonian. He really is. When you read his stuff, it's much more Wilsonian. So I would call him a bit of an aberration, even though by the time you have, after you have the invasion of Afghanistan, and you certainly have the influences of people like Brzezinski as National Security counsel advisor, that he gets pulled back into it in some respects. But he's an aberration. I mean, at least what he wanted to do, right, is an aberration. Reagan, I think, is very much in the Truman line. And then he wants to get out of the Cold War box, but he does it differently. He still does it. It's like, I'm going to take containment to the maximum and push it, right? I'm going to, you know, he probably, his people probably had NSC 68 in front of him, and they're like, okay, let's go. Let's get on that train and go. And you can see that in some of the papers that are coming out of the Reagan administration, especially some of those documents with respect to Poland, anything having to do with respect to Africa and Latin America. You just see it all laid out. Here's a transitional figure, right? You've got the Soviet Union. You have the Berlin Wall falling in '89. You've got the Soviet Union collapsing at the end of '91. And you have somebody who had a lifelong career of service who ends up as president. And somebody who tried to come up with a vision and defined it a lot of different ways during his presidency. Everything from, you know, what sounded like idealism to what sounded like sort of a, you know, a soft realism. he's an interesting figure in this respect. But I don't know, you know, he was better as a vice president. That's what I was, I mean, in terms of being able to lay out, right, a vision for people, and here's what we're going to do, and here's our approach. It was also not an easy time, right, that he was president. you know, then you get into your post-Cold War era. Clinton seems to have been very much inspired by his great Democratic oppressor's rhetoric, especially somebody like a JFK. I mean, we know about his youthful enthusiasm about JFK. He's an interesting, I mean, if you're going to use the archetypes again, he's kind of an interesting combination of ideals and realism at the same time in what he was doing in foreign policy. And he shows how difficult it is to do it, how difficult it is to do foreign policy when you don't have an overarching conflict. I mean, it's really hard to do foreign policy at any time, it turns out, right? Whether you've got an epic struggle like the Cold War, whether you've got a hot war like World War II, or whether you have the 1990s, the period of, you know, was the democratic peace dividend or not, and what was going on, and, you know, and then you had things falling apart in certain parts of the world, and what were we supposed to be doing, and, you know, Bosnia and Africa, I mean, you know. And then Bush, I think it's been very interesting to see his growth and understanding in foreign policy. He's somebody who had not traveled a lot before he was president. I mean, you know, he knew Mexico a bit, but he didn't. He really did not. He did not. I mean, you know, as governor too, right? He had to. He. But a lot of that was commercial. He was a pretty quick study in a lot of ways. And Condoleezza Rice was somebody that he became intimate with. You know, when he was campaigning, she was really tutoring him. You have to kind of follow her arc and look at how she understands foreign policy. I mean, he's his own man, but to understand how he was being taught by her and then what he has learned and decided to do on his own and with his advisors since September 11th. But I think he's striving to somehow be in that great Truman tradition, something that does give you a common American understanding where Truman could still be a Democrat, Vandenberg could still be a Republican, you know, on and on down the line. Everybody can still be whatever party they were going to be, but at the water's edge, they could say, okay, we are now united. We are going to go forward. It's not going to be perfect all the time, but this is what we're striving for, and we're going to have our bipartisan foreign policy. And I don't know that Bush could get to that point, but I think there's a piece of him that in some of his speeches, every once in a while, he seems to want to do that. And probably now we have too many comments from people, but go ahead.
If Lieberman should lose, is that the end of that wing of the Democrats?
Lieberman the hawk. Right, Lieberman the hawk in the Truman tradition of foreign policy. If Lieberman loses, you've got Dick Durbin, you know. You've got some who have bits and pieces, but you do not have a stalwart in the Democratic Party of somebody who has real stature
There's no Scoop Jackson.
No, there's no Scoop Jackson. And I didn't, since we were only talking about presidents, I think he's an extremely important character in this entire period, and again shows how much of an aberration Jimmy Carter is by doing the comparison contrast between the two of them. And again, also how Nixon and, you know, the comparison contrast with Scoop Jackson shows you how much, where Nixon's an aberration. So yeah, no, there's nobody like that. I mean, the Republicans have a mess right now, but the Democrats have a mess right now. Both parties have a mess right now when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, they have messes elsewhere, too, but we've only been talking about foreign policy. So they have a mess when it comes to foreign policy, both sides.
When we're talking about getting back to Truman being near great,
right,
or how he's evaluated, and how historians have evaluated him over the decades, I guess maybe I'm just a little skeptical. I think that he's being invoked to some extent now by President Bush, because I think it says a lot more about the president's people evaluating the feel of the country, the people. I think a lot of people in the United States would like the straight shooting of Harry Truman, and I think therefore he's being evoked as somebody that they are like, when in fact they're not like that. I mean, I think it's, people are tired of spin, and so they're saying, well, look at that, we're not spinning this stuff, it's real. Just like Harry.
Right. You'll have to ask Peter to invite me back in a couple of years, because I think I am going to explore more where you can do comparisons and contrasts between the Truman era and the Bush era. I think that's what I have too many ideas of what I want to do next, but I think that's the one that I'm going to settle on. So anyway, you know, obviously we can't talk about that question right now, because that would take us to, you know, I don't know, we only have till 2 and I've got a flight and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But I would like to pursue that line of conversation.
You said earlier that Harry Truman had a great regard for the office of chief executive, but then when he left, he wanted to return to becoming a private citizen. Did he ever comment after his presidency on how he saw himself in that? Not the office of president, but how Harry Truman viewed Harry Truman.
As president, though, mm-hmm. Not in the office of, yeah.
Right.
He at one point said that there was a sort of Trumanism, and that it was largely his Cold War policy, and also what he had tried to do on the domestic front, and that you could look and see that there was a coherent kind of Trumanism. And I think I footnote some reference to that in the book, but also there are a couple of other points at which he talks about that. And when he talks about it in the Cold War context, it's largely in the way, you know, sort of going through what Churchill praised him for. So he did self-consciously understand that he had laid out a new foreign policy, right? He was proud of being in the Democratic Party. You know, he thought Wilson had been great. He, you know, there were problems with FDR, but he wasn't going to say FDR hadn't been a great president, right? So, you know, he was proud of these 20th century giants who had preceded him. But he knew that he had done something new and different. But he also thought he had done something that was American. It was in keeping with, what the past generations had said America would be in a position to do once they were of the status of the other great nations. And so that's interesting, too, to sort of trace that through. And he was, you know, he really liked the founders. Jefferson, he liked Washington. He liked Washington a lot, Jefferson. He liked Jackson. You know, sometimes you see that Jacksonian strain in him. But these things are all held together because the Cold War draws something out of him. If he had been president at a different time, you know, he might have made different choices, right? He could have ended up being more Wilsonian. He could have ended up being more Rooseveltian. But the Cold War forced him to think about certain things, forced certain things out of him. And the way in which he responded is what he really summarizes as Trumanism. Yes?
In 48, if the headline had been right, doing one,
right.
What do you see that? You didn't mention that.
I don't think that would have been good. I mean, if you No. Once again, I'm really glad with the outcome of that one.
We would have been isolationist when we would be.
I think he might have pulled back more. I also don't think he had the. I don't know, what would we say? Does Truman have imagination? The understanding, the experience, the all of that Dewey wouldn't have had, and he probably would have, 48. Funding of the Marshall Plan could have been much different. I don't know how the North Atlantic Treaty would have turned out. I don't know, all of that stuff leading up to NATO. And then you've got the setup of the Atlantic Alliance, but remember, it's in the early 50s that you start really making it much more armed and doing more things in the military sense of it. So I don't think you would have had that. You certainly wouldn't have had any of the growing concerns about how are we going to do things in terms of public diplomacy and explaining the conflict through an expanded Voice of America, through Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. You wouldn't have had the religious dimension that Truman brings to it. I think all of that would have been much different. What it would have been instead, I don't know, because Dewey wasn't always he was trying to run, but he didn't have like a laid out approach.
He would have followed Taft.
Right, and now Taft signed off on things. I mean, this Taft wasn't as much of an isolationist as a lot of people like to say. But it would have been different, and it wouldn't have been. Let's say if it had been more Taft-like, it would have been more Taft-like than more Vandenberg-like. Let's put it that way. Yes.
Here's a weird scenario for you. 52. The Democrats managed to convince Eisenhower to run. The Republicans draft MacArthur. Who wins?
Oh, gosh.
Based on the Cold War.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me just tell you how great it's been. To be with you, I really enjoyed this. If you all have any follow-up questions, please feel free to email me. It's elizabeth.spalding, and since you have my book, you know there's no U in Spalding. I would like to say my husband is related to the Sporting Goods family, and I think there's some remote cousin connection, but all it's ever done is get us like a reservation at a restaurant every once in a while. But anyway, elizabeth.spalding@cmc.edu. So that's for Claremont McKenna College, cmc.edu. If you ever have any follow-up questions, we didn't talk about this, which to me would be very important, but I know it's probably too detailed for you, but the whole notion of collective defense on the part of Truman versus collective security on the part of Wilson and others. But anyway, any sorts of questions, I would be happy to follow up with you. And it's been a delight. I really enjoyed it. And I hope you have a good day.